Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Over the past 50 years, we've experienced two digital revolutions which have fundamentally altered daily life. One is in computing, the other in communication. But today we're entering a third digital revolution, and that is the one in fabrication. In this hour, we'll discuss what widespread digital fabrication could mean for the future. Joining us are three brothers. They are co-authors of the book Designing Reality, How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. They are Neil Gershenfeld, director of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms, Alan Gershenfeld, the co-founder and president of E-Line Media, and Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. He is a professor at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
First place, this is an absolutely wonderful book. But it starts with this notion that we are entering into the third phase, the third digital revolution. So, Neil, I'm going to ask you to tell us what is that and what were the first two?
So, let's see. Can I tell you what's going to happen in the next 50 years? How about that?
That would be good.
Yeah. So, and I'll start by telling you what happened in the last 50 years and how they align. We've had digital revolutions in communication and computation. Phones got worse with distance. We now have the internet. Analog computers got worse with time. The longer it ran, the worse the answer was. You now carry a supercomputer in your pocket. We're entering into a third digital revolution. This one is in fabrication. It brings the digital world into the physical world. So to understand what that means, let's first look at the computer one. There were mainframes, and so MIT built the first real-time computer, the Whirlwind, and it filled a whole building. It cost $1 million, and there was one of them. Then came mini computers. They cost $100,000. They filled the room, and the mini computers were used to invent the internet, word processing, video games. All those things happened. It wasn't yet something an individual owned, but a work group could own one, and they didn't need the approval of the management. And so all of modern computing really happened at that stage. Then came the hobbyist computers, like the Altair. Those cost about $10,000. And when that first came out, the killer app was you could flip switches to load a program in, and then the lights would blink as it ran the program in binary. That was it. But there was this funny little company that got started on it called Micro-Soft. And eventually they took the dash out and became Microsoft. And the first time it came to the Bay Area, that computer, they gathered an event for it and they called it the Homebrew Computer Club, and it became Apple. And so that machine led to the whole generation. It was personal but not yet universal. Okay? And there were about 1 million of those. Then came smartphones and tablets and all of that. Now we're getting down below $1,000. You get to that, and then finally you get to Internet of Things. I don't know if there's one here, but like a smart thermostat. Okay, those, we're approaching 1 trillion of them. They're down to like $1 each. But the smart thermostat has the power of the mini computer. The mini computer used to invent the internet and video processing and word games, your thermostat has that power. Okay, so that's the last 50 years. It went from 1,000 to 1,000,000 to 1,000,000,000 to trillion, literally. Now, Gordon Moore, founder of Intel, in 1965, wrote an amazing article called Cramming More Components Onto an Integrated Circuit, where he took 5 data points on the number of transistors, noticed they lined up like they were doubling, and said, what if that continues for 10 years? In that amazing article, he forecast everything that happened. If you were looking on a linear graph, it would look like nothing's happening, and then it goes boom. But if you take the logarithm, which measures doubling, it lines up on a straight line. So the only thing he got wrong was it went for 50 years. In 1965, he could forecast the next 50 years. All of that is digital computing and communication. The reason we're here today is 1952, MIT made the first computerized manufacturing machine, connecting a computer to a machine to make parts. One of those cost $1 million. The lab I run at MIT has the descendants of that, the $1 million machines. For outreach for the National Science Foundations, we started setting up these community fab labs. They cost $100,000, but can roughly do what the $1 million one does on a community scale. We had one, then two, and then they started doubling. Doubling time is 1.5 years, and there's now about 1,500 of them. there's well over 1,000. These community labs that easily fit in this room let you technology to create technology. You can create, make machines to grow food. You can create consumer electronics. You can create housing. All of those things you buy, you can make. But more than that, you can teach classes. You can incubate businesses. And so it's created this whole network of programs of like fab cities that commit to a countdown to globally connected for data, but local self-sufficiency, and a global humanitarian lab for humanitarian relief. And so Bill Foster, remaining physicist in Congress, has a bill for universal access to digital fabrication based on this. We've had this great collaboration with Chevron, bringing these to communities everywhere they're working. More than us, they can tell you about this transformative impact. So we're at that stage right now. Then what's emerging, that's the $100,000 stage. Fab labs are now emerging so that they can make fab labs, meaning the machines that make stuff can make the machines that make stuff, so fab labs spread virally. That's the technology to get it down to thousands of dollars. Then they still need a global supply chain of the materials. Your supply chain that made you is 20 parts. They're called amino acids. They're molecular Lego. And a little further out in the research lab, we're developing assemblers of other kinds of molecular Lego so you can make technology out of this tiny set of parts. It doesn't change what you can make, but it changes what you need to make it. And that gets up to the billion. And then finally, we're developing assemblers that assemble themselves so the machine merges with the material, and that gets up to a trillion. And so when I say a trillion, I mean the capabilities of a fab lab in the same way the thermostat matches that. And so today, there's a very clear roadmap to go from 1 to 1,000 to a million to a billion to a trillion digital fabrication facilities. Personal computing, when it emerged, the founder of the mini computer company said, nobody needs a computer at home. They failed. You, of course, understand why you would have a computer at home. Now imagine if you can create rather than consume. So rather than getting a job to get money, to get work, to buy something, you can create it. It completely turns on its side everything about how we divide industry, aid, education, all of those things in this really profound way. Now, the things to take away from the story is all of these are happening at the same time, 1,000, million, billion, trillion, but it ranges from today to 50 years in the future. But this moment in history is right analogous to the moment when the internet and all of that was invented, where anybody can make anything anywhere. And so that's what digital fabrication is. It's a 3D printer is like the microwave oven. It's a teeny corner of it. This is the technology to bring the digital world into the physical world. So that's what this is all about.
So we've had this enthusiastic description of new technology. And I look back at the first two digital revolutions. We didn't get everything right when it came to either of them. What went right? What went wrong, Joel? And what can we learn from that?
So when we started the book, we went back to this Gordon Moore article in 1965 and then tried to find social scientists, observers, that were tuned into what he described as this exponential accelerating of technology. And it really took us to the late 1970s, early 1980s, before we had people starting to lean in and say, something's happening here. And even then, it was mostly reactive, not proactive. And in fact, a 200-year history of the social sciences is mostly reactive to technology. And so, in many ways, what's motivating the book is the fact that with the first two digital revolutions, yes, the technology has brought all these great affordances to our life, but we also have weaponized social media, we have issues of privacy, we have any number of ways in which the technology is creating unintended and deeply problematic consequences, digital divides of one kind or another. And so really, part of the story behind the book is Neil's vision is a compelling one. But there are many ways in which this could go awry, and the time to address them is early on in the technology, not 50 years after the fact.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. I'm sorry.
Don't mince words. He usually says he doesn't trust me to get it right.
Yeah. So the real
don't
world
be so
is.
Polite.
Well, actually, the backstory of the book. Sadly, our mother has passed, but about 2 years ago, advancing Alzheimer's was really claiming her consciousness. But when we visited her, she liked to hear us talk. And in talking, we came to the conclusion that on the technology, we actually believe Neil's right, that there is a 50-year roadmap. You can go into his lab today and see some of the 50-year out stuff happening today. So it's there. It's not widely distributed, but it's present today. On the other hand, we didn't trust him to get it right when it comes to how we live, learn, work, and play. And so really the story of the book is saying, how do we understand how society, social systems co-evolve with the technology?
Yeah, just a few thoughts. I mean, in 2015, President Obama did a pretty major address where he talked about how digital access, he didn't even talk about literacy, which we'll talk about, but digital access was like electricity or water. It's something that's necessary to survive and thrive in this generation. That was 50 years after Gordon Moore's article. So the thought experiment is, if you were a social scientist or a policymaker or a philanthropist or a social entrepreneur, and you sat with Gordon Moore and looked at those numbers, what would you do different right now? And when we break it down, we really break it into four big areas. There's access. So 50% of the planet, the reason I was shaking my head is 50% of the planet does not have internet access, which is part of the fab ecosystem. It's a network. That's what makes it so powerful. So right away, 50%. There's a digital divide. We're already looking at a major fab divide, but it's much worse than that because billions more have limited access. They're on a feature phone, low-end smartphone. Try doing CAD/CAM design or a Word document on a feature phone. Limited access. Many people have limited access because of dollars or money. You know, they can only get on for a certain period of time. So that's billions more that don't even have the basic foundation to have a fab lab.
Yeah, there's a really interesting division. I'm just realizing, just as a footnote, one of the readers on the book was Vint Cerf, the father of the internet. And when Alan said that, Vint got really mad. He said, like, we did really well. We got most of the planet.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's
and Alan and Joel said, no, you did really bad. You missed most of the planet.
Yeah, but it's to me, it's healthy to raise that because, again, it's very easy as a techno-optimist just to assume. But we have huge digital divides. Fab divides could make them much, much worse. And we're just talking about access there. Literacy. So during the first two digital revolutions, lots of people got computers in classrooms and whatnot, but they really had no idea what to do with it. And it was a long time before we understood digital literacy, before teachers and principals and community leaders knew how to use these powerful digital technologies. That's still a huge issue in the fab ecosystem, finding people to lead the fab labs. We often use the Carnegie analogy. Before Andrew Carnegie's philanthropy, people didn't assume you would have a library in every school and community. Broadly speaking, afterwards, it became kind of an assumption. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a fab lab in every school and community. I passionately believe that. But a lot of the Carnegie libraries failed because they didn't have librarians, and then library schools opened. We don't have the facilitators, the mentors, to run the fab lab. So that goes to the whole idea of literacy and enabling ecosystem. And we're just starting to, the book gets deep into these questions. So now we have an opportunity. It's like being with Gordon Moore in 1965, he got the technology right, but he didn't think about any of this stuff. Now we need social scientists, we need storytellers sitting with the technologists, thinking about the stuff now because everything is negotiable now.
Yeah, one of Joel's most interesting points for me in the book was that social sciences was invented in response to the Industrial Revolution, but ever since has been reactive. And there's this assumption that the social science is reactive.
Yeah. Actually, Joel, I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that because that's a really powerful point.
So Adam Smith gets credit for coming up with his ideas almost concurrent around 1776 with the rise of the Industrial Revolution. As a result, certain assumptions like the invisible hand in the marketplace co-evolved with the technology in a deeply embedded way. And in a sense, today's winner-take-all technology divides is a product of that effect, you know, over almost 300 years ago. Karl Marx came along 100 years later and said, wait a minute, who owns the means of production? Which, by the way, is
now,
we're going to come back to this in terms
of
owning
labs,
the means of production with fab labs. But it was so embedded in terms of markets and paired with technology that he could only envision a revolutionary overthrow as the only way that that could change. Yeah. Yeah. There are a number of reformers that came up with different models over the years, and essentially they were hard to scale and hard to sustain. And so we have a situation in which social scientists have been very good at describing the adverse effects of the Industrial Revolution, of globalization, of many of the different things that have come with technology, but not as good as leaning in and co-creating the social systems that can co-evolve with the technology. And that's really what we're talking about.
What is the pace normally? I mean, as you think about the establishment of norms that emerges, right? It takes leadership and pushing, but it emerges. Talk about the different natural paces.
The very word institution was coined in France in the 1500s. And what's interesting to me is things like monarchies, militaries, churches were around for 1,000 years before there was even a word to describe them. They were so slow moving that people didn't even have a word for it. Fast forward to the Industrial Revolution, things like political parties, trade unions, other institutions emerged not in 500 to 1,000 years, but 50 to 100 years. Fast forward to today, whole institutional arrangements are emerging in 5 to 10 years. The rules of the game can change very rapidly. That's both good and bad. But it really sets the stage for us having a conversation about shaping institutions that can work at the same pace as the technology.
To make that concrete, one of the interesting things that first, writing this book was a horrible experience, in case it sounds happy. Joel described it as a four-letter word. But one of the interesting parallels that emerged is the recognition that if the machines can make the machines, meaning a lab can make a lab, you need organizations that make organizations. Mm. Yet the organizations need to be able to scale in that same fan-out way as the machines fan out. And if you descend deeper, many of the principles we're using in this idea of digitizing materials have really interesting parallels with how to architect organizations that have that same kind of scalability.
Yeah, I'll build on that. One of the things I learned a lot about both brothers' disciplines. One of the things I learned about actually digital technology, even though I spent my career making digital stuff, is this idea.
Alan breaks technology by looking at it. just to be clear,
this idea, of error correction is really interesting. When Neil talked about how analog calls degrade with distance, but digital calls actually get better. Digital technologies can essentially error correct, and it gets better with volume, which is why you have these billions of people who can connect to digital technologies. What's interesting is individuals, organizations, and institutions also error correct. We just do it much slower. That said, there are lots of models for how organizations, institutions, and people can error correct, and there are clues, which Neil was just alluding to, in the technology, which actually have clues in biology, bioanalogies, as to how we can detect and correct errors. And we're now going, that's a thread that we're pursuing from the book, because at the end of the day, a lot of the pain points exist because the digital technology is exponential, but we're all error correcting at a more linear pace. How do we close that? And again, we can unpack that on lots of different levels, but to me, that was a really interesting insight that
so
came from the book.
So give us concrete examples of institutions that are error correcting.
Yeah, Joel, I'll do one in video. We'll do one in each of our sectors, which is interesting because we're in totally different sectors.
Yeah.
You want to go first?
So why don't you each explain your sectors? You haven't introduced yourselves.
Okay. Short version. Our parents were both labor arbitrators. As the oldest son, I in effect went into the family business. I do work initially in labor management relations. I helped Ford and the UAW re-architect their collective bargaining process as an example, and have then moved into multi-stakeholder alignment in complex systems that go beyond just union management relations. That's the short version. So when Neil talks about the science of digital, it begins with things being modular. Bits, bytes, packets, things that you can assemble and disassemble with the error correction so that you don't have degradation of quality over distance. We know that organizations and institutions can form in modular forms, teams, different groups in ways. We know that organizations and institutions don't like to be disassembled, and so there's a challenge there. But there is evidence of forms that are scalable and adaptable. Some public-private partnerships turn out to be better than either markets or regulation with natural resources, for example. Eleanor Ostrom got a Nobel Prize for her work on that. And so what I've seen is that it's possible to take individual organizations and groups and combine them together to create what are really new institutional arrangements that are laterally connected, where they're not giving up their autonomy, but they're all agreeing that there are certain things that they can do together that they couldn't do separately. It does involve, for example, in the area of safety, near miss reporting, ways to see things that could go wrong before they do, ways of doing error correction or error proofing on social systems. And as Alan said, it's still a linear process in most cases, not an exponential process. But I think that we can sort of stretch our mind to say, imagine organizations that could assemble and disassemble, but with a safety net so that people aren't in harm's way, and then repair and rebuild and have mechanisms to do this kind of error correction so that they can work at that exponential rate.
Alan.
Well, so my background was movies in Hollywood and China. Then I helped rebuild the video game company Activision, ran their studios for many years. I got really interested in the impact, good and bad, of video games. I became chairman of a nonprofit called Games for Change to rise the sector of games for learning, health, social impact. And for the last 10 years, I've had a social impact double bottom line company doing that, bringing the rigor of an Activision to the impact game space. We've done everything from civic engagement in the Middle East. I saw Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Dunn. We worked on the Half the Sky games. Our largest investor is an Alaska Native tribe. We did a game in the Inupiat language with them that's been very, very popular. A lot, very diverse games. One example that's not in my sector, but that's relevant, is if you look at safety in airlines, how accidents are reported. I believe you have 24 hours before there's any blame where you can report it. You have the black box. There's a whole culture of if something happens, everybody shares it. And look at the airline safety. It's incredible versus, say, medical review boards. Like, those are examples of institutional arrangements around risk. They're obviously apples and oranges, but there's a lot of insights if you look at it with the right lens. Video games, video game communities, like a lot of internet, has a lot of toxic behavior. And this isn't something I was involved with, but I write about it in the book. There's a game called League of Legends. It's like 70 million people. It's done by a company called Riot Games. Massive global audience. The toxicity had reached such a level that they were having trouble attracting new players and were scaring away players within the community. And so they hired neuroscientists, social scientists, and they had an incredible data set, and they would track negative comments and positive comments. Just track it through the community with all sorts of really interesting visualization tools. And then with the community buy-in, they started to do a really interesting tests, all sorts of tests to see if they could reduce the negative comments. And where a lot of the insights came is, first of all, there has to be community buy-in, but the communication had to be instant. Like, if it was a day later, it was not effective. It had to have a visual of what the transgression was. Because what they found is it wasn't a few really bad eggs. It was a lot of people who were basically good people, but were going with kind of the norms. And if you saw the transgression, you saw why the community bought in, it's just started to drop dramatically. And then they figured out positive reinforcement on the positive behavior. This has all been published in Nature recently. They're sharing this research. Blizzard, who does World of Warcraft, is now looking at some of this research. That's an example of error correction around what is a serious issue in our society, which is toxicity online. So there are solutions out there that frankly need more support, more research. And that's error correction at an institutional or organizational level. There's lots of other examples we talk about, but that's just one.
And I'll give one other example. That's sort of at the personal behavioral level using this nudge approach.
But also very sophisticated machine learning. There's a lot of technology in what they do, actually.
Right. And that's a good example in which the technology is accelerating.
And when you refer to nudge, that's sort of the behavioral economics.
Exactly. Mondragon is a cooperative in Spain that I think is also worth citing as an example. It was founded 50 years ago by a Catholic priest who had this vision of an alternative to capitalism. Today, it's the producer of most of the white goods in Europe, refrigerators, washers, dryers, what have you. There's about 70 companies employing 70,000 people. But what's interesting is it has an ecosystem that includes a bank that, if your business fails, will fund you to launch a new business, or send you for training and education. It has childcare, it has healthcare. It's a whole different conception of how you run a community in which there is no penalty for failure, and there's lots of opportunities to do new things. They have this cluster, Conocimiento, which is a group that has 17 working groups on the future of technology, including a working group on digital materials for 3D printing.
I didn't mention to you, Mondragon University just came to visit me at MIT to talk about how they introduced digital fabrication into their whole ecosystem.
So the good thing about the Mondragon story is, unlike many of the other experiments, it has now survived for 50 years. The bad thing is that there's been dozens of books, hundreds of thousands, literally, of visitors over the years that wanted to replicate it with very little success. Mm-hmm. And so the real challenge is, can we come up with social systems that aren't dependent on local culture, because the Basque culture is a real bind that ties people together in that case, but that they can work across sectors, across societies.
Neil, I want to take you back to the Fab Labs, because this is a network of its own, right? And it, with its own social system that's emerging.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah. So over and over we find isolated maker spaces tend to fail. And the power is the network. So think about a computer by itself on your desk and think about the internet. Bob Metcalfe famously said the power of a computer goes as the square of the number of computers connected in the network, because that's everybody you can interact with.
So Bob Metcalfe came up with Ethernet, but
yeah,
go ahead.
Right. And so what we find over and over is, like, in a typical random makerspace, where do you get the technology? What's the right way to use it? There's a thing called Arduinos you use, which is a little programmable circuit board you can buy for $30. But, you know, in a Fab Lab, you can learn to make one for $1. Then you learn what's under it. And then you learn to use a 3D printer. But then you learn to use the other machines. Then you learn to make the machines. Then you connect to teach the classes and then to get funding. And over and over, we find these isolated ones fail. The ones in networks work. And in fact, the ones... a common question is, like, what's the business model? And what we find is you could sell products made in the lab, you could pay to teach classes, you could have membership, you could have open community time, you can create civic infrastructure, and the ones succeed to do all of that. There's great synergies among them. It's a little bit like asking, what's the business model of a library? And it's a resource for knowledge, but this is sort of a new literacy making it physical. Mm-hmm. So over and over, we find the power is the network.
But surely there's a role for culture and context in all this. Say, when you look at a Fab Lab in Afghanistan, or decisions made in the same way they are in Boston?
To a surprising amount, no. And that's what's so interesting. So nobody's pushing these. This doubling just, it went, so in the book, for writing the book, I plotted the data, and there's much more data than Gordon Moore had for this 10 years of doubling. Nobody planned that. It's just every time you open one, another one opens. And I naively thought, like, poor places would deal with poor problems, and rich places would do rich problems, and cultures would do... It turns out what's really interesting is they're used the same way everywhere, not the different way, in that in each of these places, bright, inventive people want to learn, want to create, want to invent, create art,
actually,
play.
I disagree.
We should write a book about that. over and over, we find what's striking is each time one of these comes in, there's a sense we're different from all the other ones, and here's our local things. But they end up being much more similar than different.
But it's in essence a platform, right? I'm sorry, Joel. Yeah.
So Neil's right.
Why do you disagree?
In one sense, that the things that people do in a Fab Lab have enormous parallels across the ecosystem. In another sense, and first I want to give props to Neil. He doesn't have a Rolodex, but he essentially said, here's my Rolodex, call anyone you want. And Alan and I made 50 or 60 interviews as part of the book.
What's wrong with my brother interviews?
No.
They were amazing. We should have just published the transcripts. They are remarkable people all over the world.
Yeah, it really was. But what we heard is that the killer app of a Fab Lab wasn't so much what people made, but the collaborative process of design. And so the reason why I said I disagree is that on the Peace Wall in Ireland, it was Protestants and Catholics designing together, and literally setting aside histories of struggle because they were just focused on the task at hand. Mm-hmm. Those same people are now in Colombia helping with the reintegration of the FARC, again, using Fab Labs as kind of a boundary object, at the boundary of different communities, connecting them together in new ways. Mm-hmm. And the reason I said I disagree is that, yes, there are parallels in each case, but in another case, they're each their own story of which cultures are coming together in which ways, and kind of creating their own narrative of how does this technology fit into our community. And so in that sense, there are unique stories to tell that are different on the slope of Alaska than they are in rural India, yeah. And so on.
I was actually just back from the Arctic Circle, which was very interesting. We're working on a future Alaska Native world build, imagining the Arctic in 20 years. We're looking at a lot of accelerating technologies, whether it's blockchain, AI, and saying, what would that look like if Alaska Native values that have lasted for thousands of years were embedded in the technology now? It's a very interesting project. I'm going to do a half glass empty and a half glass full comment on this idea of the network. One of the things that came out with the network is actually the power of it, unlike, say, an isolated makerspace or tech shop, is that because there's a common footprint of additive, like 3D printers, subtractive, like laser cutters, ShopBots, different ways of doing embedded computing, CAD, computer-aided design, CAM, computer-aided manufacturing software workflows, you do get a network. Unfortunately, it's a total mishmash of proprietary software, open software, rapidly emerging machines, and there was a lot of frustration in the process. There's a lot of friction in the process. This is a really interesting field. It's more Joel's field. The idea of, everybody wants standards, but they want their standard. The longer you go, the more entrenched interests get, and the harder it is to do standards. So there is a lot of friction. I think reducing that friction will greatly accelerate the network effect. And I think that's an interesting thing to surface and to sort of talk about. The power of it, I think if you look at Neil's 50-year roadmap, which broadly I think Joel and I buy into, the deeper we got into, and when I say we bought into it, so did the many people that we interviewed, including naysayers that are sort of skeptics a little bit, generally bought into the roadmap. Right now, Neil talks about making what you can consume, but I've been to their house. There's very little in there that was made in a fab lab. I've been to a lot of people who are leaders in the fab lab. There's very little made in a fab lab. Right now, the process is incredible. Every single person we talk to, they swear by the Fab Lab. Making is wonderful. It's very easy for people to tear down things, tear down governments. It's very hard to build things back up. Fab Labs are all about making. So the process, it's not just the literacies, and they're multiple. You have software literacies, hardware literacies, biochemistry, all the stuff you need in the consumables, the materials you use to make things. There's just an incredible way of literacies. That makes it challenging, but a great project-based learning experience. I think we'll see a curve over time. To me, there should be a Fab Lab in every school and in every community just for the education, for the project-based learning, for the cultivation of things like critical thinking, problem-solving, creativity, collaboration. Over time, the things that come out of the Fab Lab will become more and more powerful, and individuals and communities can become more and more sustainable. And we can urge that along, but it's not like that's here now.
But I want to talk about the tangible intangibles. Like, remember, Google took a number of years to figure out it gives away search. It doesn't sell search. It sells the benefits of searching. In the same sense, Fab Labs make a thing, but many of the most important products aren't the thing, it's the benefits of making the thing in a really tangible way. So Blair Evans has Fab Labs in Detroit working with at-risk youth, teenage pregnancy, juvenile delinquents, injustice, and he brings them in the lab and he delivers better life outcomes than the social services on offer in a way he can quantify and price and measure the impact. This example in Northern Ireland was there was post-EU Troubles reconciliation money and they really didn't know what to spend it on. This taking people across what they're called the peace walls that are really the war walls has this profound impact on the viability of the community. These things are really, really valuable in a way you can really price, but the benefit isn't the widget, it's the benefits of having made the widget.
We've been hearing from Neil, Allen, and Joel Gershenfeld on the digital revolution in fabrication, the benefits it brings, and the challenges it may pose. After the break, we'll discuss best practices in the fabrication revolution. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from three brothers who are the co-authors of the book, How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. They are Neil Gershenfeld, director of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms, Alan Gershenfeld, the co-founder and president of E-Line Media, and Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld, a professor at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, one word. And now back to our program.
We didn't touch on making guns and bombs and bad people making bad things and bio risks. That was a whole chapter, a whole section in the book. That's real. You know, Neil, and people are making 3D printing guns.
Let's slow this down a little bit. I mean, the notion is you can produce living organisms, right?
Yep.
You can produce the weapon itself.
Things that blow up and hurt
things
people.
Things that blow up and hurt people. This is accessible to all. It makes me feel less good about some of the fab labs, about where they are. So, what are the norms for...
So at its core, an institution has to do two things. It has to create value and it has to mitigate harm. Right now, 95% of the energy in the fab ecosystem is around creating value, whether it's social intangibles or physical objects.
As it was with the first two digital
Same thing, exactly. Yeah. And the mechanisms to mitigate harm in the first two came so late that, you know,
we're... a lot of harm.
Yeah, and it's hard to do
it's
it
hard to
otherwise.
It's hard to reverse, yeah.
So in the fab ecosystem, just about a month ago, there was an unexpected and horrible event in the town of Grenoble, France. Two fellows firebombed the lab as a protest against technology. First time something like that has happened. And that's launched a conversation to say, how do we think about safety and security at the facility level, at the regional level, and at the global level? And that will require forums, mechanisms, institutional arrangements that don't presently exist.
But Neil, what are you doing about it? I mean, the reality is it is possible to build a weapon.
Yeah.
It is possible that the proliferation can be huge, can be fast.
So we work with groups like DHS and FBI on these. And it's very similar, very deeply similar to the biotechnology risk issues. In the short term, 3D printed guns are terrible guns, and hobbyists have been making guns since the beginning of guns. And not only that, you don't even, I'm sure I could go out on the street, on Sutter Street, and in 10 minutes buy a gun. So in the short term, you don't need the fab lab to buy or make a gun. But what's emerging in the long term is, and this is very similar to what happened in biotechnology, is this is leaky. There isn't a point of control. You can't prevent the spread. What you can do is provide incentives to do this in communities. And so what we find in fab labs is when people come in and they want to make weapons, the community helps steer them towards not doing that, but there's an incentive to not do this in secret, in private, because you get so much in being in the community. And so, you know, when I brief room full of army generals or intelligence analysts, half of them gasp and say we have to control it, but the other half of the army generals, intelligence analysts gasp at the first half saying, you know, this is the most fundamental thing you can do to get at the root causes of the conflict, and there's no control point anyway, and it's left the barn, and we need to provide incentives to opt in.
So we're not happy with Neil's response there, yeah. Which is part of the reason why we wrote the book. Because there is a lot of naivete. I mean, the argument that this is going to get better and faster and personal, but it's not efficient, it's just that's not an acceptable argument in my mind. What Joel's doing now with this remarkable guy, Patrick Hogan, who leads the Irish Fab Labs and who helped broker the peace movement in Ireland and Northern Ireland, he was just in Colombia, we need more people like that. There's a lot of things we can do. Some of them are technology. We can be developing technology that senses materials that might be destructive. I mean, there are literally hundreds of solutions they're starting to come up with that are not waving your hand and say it's not inefficient. It's inefficient now, or it'll just be community
the guns
norms.
Are crummy.
Yeah, there are a lot of things we can do. A lot of smart people who care deeply about this need to start to look at them, and they need to be baked into the social norms, the technologies, the institutions, the charters. Whether it's at a school, whether it's at a community center, whether it's a public-private partnership. Bottom line is we have to be proactive.
That's right.
We have to have a sense of urgency because it's easier to do now, and we can't wave off these problems, which is why we should write a book about this.
And by the way, some of the inherited arrangements are actually deeply problematic. Worse than the guns or the bombs that someone could make, I actually think there are social controls that we can set up to set up norms and what have you. On the other hand, something like biofab is just so far removed from medical ethical control panels, as Alan mentioned, that there the inherited institutions are not even closely matched to what's happening with the technology and the ability to release a disease that could be devastating or any number of other things that could go wrong. And so we have some serious work to do, some of which will happen with existing institutions that have to reinvent themselves, and some of which will happen with new arrangements that essentially emerge. You know, you look at what's happening, this is a completely separate example, but in Florida, with the kids reaching out laterally and it becomes a movement, that's very powerful. Now the question is, what's the sustaining ecosystem around that that makes that not just a one-time event, but something that is a part of our society in a beneficial way? And that's the kind of conversation about new organizational structures. They're not going to be hierarchical. There won't be a single entity in charge. They're going to be more lateral, distributed, but they still have to have the kind of expertise that's needed to make a difference on some of these big issues.
Yeah, and I would pick up on that I thought the technology roadmap was hard. In a sense, that's been easy. What's been hard is, we work with nonprofits on aid and entrepreneurs on business and schools and education, and it was always a disaster because they kept doing the last war. Yes. And what we found is you need to really invent new sort of organizations and institutions, and it's really hard. To make it concrete, if you take the computer remote I'm holding, today this might have been made in China, then a ship brought it on the sea, and then it went into a port to go through customs. Then it went to a train that went down tracks, and then a truck went down a highway to go to a store in a building where then you had to have a job to get money to pay taxes and finally buy this. So that's sort of what we do today. If you went into a fab lab and made this, it's not free, it's not utopia, but if you reduce it to the cost of the materials, you don't need the import customs, you don't need the highway toll booths, you don't need the building managers, you don't need the store checkout. Most of those functions of governance go away. On the other hand, people are using fab labs to start to make things like cars or ovens or things that can be really dangerous. You can't regulate them. You have to make incentives to opt in. And so in a really interesting way, it's going to sort of wipe out a lot of what traditional government does, as embodied in this example. But it means you need a new notion of government that's not based on command and control, but how you add value through governance.
Well, you need governance.
That leads exactly. Incentives to opt in, not command and control the mandate.
Mm-hmm. Right now, there are those who feel that the first digital revolution has been very destructive to government and to, but not just government, governance, the whole process of collectively coming together, thinking about what is the larger social good as opposed to the individual good. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this, Neil, is going to be the biggest challenge?
Well, I think, one of the differences is the last round right now has ended up at this precarious moment in history where Google and Facebook and Amazon won, and we're all sort of data slaves to feeding this big machine. Mm-hmm. There's sort of this funny state we backed into, and there's this sort of central command and control. And so an obvious question is, does that happen now? But there's a lot of reasons, again, I'm more optimistic than them, but there's a lot of reasons to believe this one plays out differently. In a way, it's sort of back to the future. It's not simply a return to an agrarian society because it's based on global connectivity for knowledge, but local self-sufficiency for the materials. But when people approach me about I'm gonna become the Apple or at the time the IBM of PCs for digital fab, I have to explain, if the machines can make the machines, it's not a great business to make the machines.
Or to do a monopoly. Let me just hang on, though, to a set of governance questions, but this sort of suggested end to mass production. right? Because I thought you were going to say the killer app is personalization.
The answer to that, in 1984, Mike Puri and Chuck Sable wrote a book called The Second Industrial Divide. And what they argued is that the first industrial divide, the Industrial Revolution, when that came along, it wasn't that craft work disappeared. You still needed machinists to make the machines that ran the mass production industry, but the craft technology receded as secondary and mass production became primary. They were one of the first to be looking at this computerization and what does it mean, and they said that there would be this emerging technology around what they called flexible specialization. They looked at Benetton in northern Italy being able to respond to demand in rapid ways. They didn't fully anticipate digital fabrication accelerating in the way that it is, but in a sense it's a story in which mass markets won't disappear, but it's conceivable that they will be secondary to local markets. When you have increased local productive capability, you may have also blockchain abilities to do barter and exchange and other mechanisms as well, so that you'll get a blend.
And let me strengthen blend, because it's a false dichotomy of mass versus personal. If you look at computing, software, music, the 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, role. Mm. You know, if you, you know, the record label still exists and you can make tunes for yourself and you can share tracks with 10 people and you can sell it to 100 people and you can make a little business for 1,000. And so you can personally fabricate one thing that's exactly what you want. You can do a short run in your community. You can do a slightly longer run down the road. You'll mass produce things still, but those are the boring things that everybody needs the same thing. They're all going to exist at the same time.
It's also where you need standards is where I was headed, is that one advantage of mass production is that there is you can apply standards that everyone understands, and when you buy that, you can trust that it has lived up to them.
One more thing to follow up on that. We've been working very closely with the Shenzhen manufacturing ecosystem. That today is where a lot of manufacturing happens.
Right.
And they're way ahead of most of the world in getting, if everything we're talking about here happens, you no longer need Shenzhen to mass produce the products. But for many, many years, there's a role in mass producing the ingredients that let you do the local production of the products. So we're actually making a really aggressive pivot to mass producing the enabling building blocks for local production.
Alan.
You know, in our 40 to 50 interviews, probably the biggest fear was the sort of Apple, the big company coming in. And I don't think it's as simple quite as it's been outlined, because even if you look at the distribution, as the person to my left, even if you look at the distribution of music and the power of the platforms like Apple for discovery, for how you find stuff, I mean, it's incredible how centralized it still is. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of discussion as to what is the role of big business. On one level, Neil often talks about the Star Trek replicator, and he's building the replicator. A lot of people in the fab ecosystem hated that analogy, because Captain Picard, if the Earl Grey tea did not come out hard, Cott probably couldn't have fixed it. It feels like an Apple black box. So there's a lot of questions, even about our mental maps of what the future looks like. Who controls...
And by the way, that's governance built into technology.
Yeah, I mean, who controls the supply chain for even the local raw materials or the things that can't be made locally, because not everything can be used local materials. I mean, further out, there is a concept of digital materials, but probably the biggest concern was around the role of business. On the flip side, the first two digital revolutions, Gordon Moore founded Intel. Intel spent billions and billions and billions of dollars of research to stay ahead of Moore's Law. We often, when we do talks, we put up a picture of Indiana Jones running in front of the big boulder, because an executive at Intel told us that's the mental map in Intel. The boulder's Moore's Law, and Intel's just trying to stay ahead of it. That costs billions and billions of dollars. So there is a question of where will the research dollars come to maintain the 50-year trajectory? I think there's an interesting trend that's happening. which is billions and billions of dollars are going into impact investing right now. If you look around from the Ford Foundation to the Heron Foundation to all of the wealth that's been created in Silicon Valley with the family foundations, people are looking to try to figure out how to create sustainable economic returns, how to do things that either scale or propagate to do lots of people, but still have a social charter, an impact charter, where their board, their stakeholders, their investors. I think that's going to be critical to the Fab ecosystem to answer almost all of the different questions, because it's going to need capital, it's going to need markets, it's got to be grounded in aspirational values that are shared broadly by the community.
And to pick that up and go one step beyond that, one of the things that both breaks my heart, but what's the opposite of, like, assembles my heart, what's the opposite of breaking your heart, is the defining battles right now of, like, leave versus remain in Brexit and the election between Hillary and Trump, and right now the trade wars versus, they assume in opposition is globalism or setting up walls and nationalism or localism. And there's this axis that those in opposition. What the last hour has been about is it's just a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. The bits can travel and the atoms can stay. And rather than viewing business as the creator of jobs that creates wealth, you can sort of do an end run around that debate. And one of the interesting things we see happening is, like, you know, when I go to some of the events I see you of global leaders, generally they're just sort of, and CEOs, they're sort of depressed. A lot's going wrong. When I'm in the settings, and Joel and Alan have been to many of these, and, you know, Chevron colleagues have been to many of these, the people on the ground doing what we're describing, they're really excited and they're changing the world, but they're not where everybody's looking. And so there's sort of this end run around the defining baits of the day that actually is happening.
But I want to bring it back, though, I'm sorry, yeah. You talk about standards, and there's one piece of the standards that is really complicated, which is when you have safety critical components, you need traceability. And when you have a distributed ecosystem where people are sharing designs and making things, that doesn't exist. And so again, the question is, how do you take the lessons that we've learned about whether it's the safety and security of vehicles as they drive down the road or components in an airplane or what have you, we have built in a number of protections, assuming top-down corporations in which you could hold someone accountable. I think, interesting design challenge is constructing systems that still achieve those same results, but operate in what is a distributed ecosystem.
Yeah. One topic we didn't talk about is, I mean, I should say that all but one question card referred to weapons. Referred to the dangers.
Not surprised.
Which actually surprises me in Northern California. Yep. But I would expect it elsewhere.
So this really gets at what I call deeply embedded assumptions. So, for example, if you look at the digital data protection regulations in Europe, at its core is an assumption that comes out of the German Constitution that the number one thing, this comes after the horrors of World War II, is doing nothing that upsets the integrity of the whole of a person. And so privacy in the European context, particularly in Germany, isn't just a nice thing to do. It's the number one principle in the Constitution. Now, on one side, it's nice that there are those deep protections against things that we're fearful of. On the other hand, there are many critics who say that you're going to stifle innovation by over-regulating it. Europe at one time had a vibrant computer industry, and it was left in the dust by things that happened here. TCP/IP ran circles around the networking efforts that were taking place in Europe. So there's a real challenge around how to deal with the cybersecurity issues, which are increasingly frightening in their implications, without also creating constraints that stifle innovation. So there's a tension there.
So let me
but
give
even
you
the use between states, I think about as well. But go ahead.
Let me give you just one little story. We've run these labs literally where there's shooting wars and places of great conflict. And recurring in each of those places is bad people doing bad stuff have needs that are well met. they tend to not need these labs because they have great supply chains to do bad stuff already. Right. That's very well developed. So a great microcosm is, you know, one of the early labs in Egypt was on the Giza Plateau during the Morsi riots. A colleague, Dina, called and, you know, are you okay? And they kind of laughed. The bright inventive kids who had no interest in sectarian conflict took the Morsi riots as a day off to go work in the lab. And it was really productive and they were having a great time. And to me, just that little story is really profound because you can worry about the risks of the technology, which are serious. But over and over, these labs have been flourishing in places of great conflict in a really interesting way, getting at some of the root causes of conflict. And so you can be distracted by, you could make a bad thing, because there's the act of making is making a lot of good things. No technology is good and bad, but over and over we observe that in these places of conflict, they have these, like one more example. One of these labs in South Africa was in Soshanguve. It's an apartheid era township outside Pretoria. The government people we were working with when we were moving there were like quaking in the minivan that brought us there, because when they grew up, they were taught if you go there, you'll be killed, and was probably true. And it became one of the liveliest, most flourishing lab because it was their lab and they brought it into the community. And so it's really important to not view the threat in isolation, but view it against the transformative impact. So,
but when you refer to the root causes, you're thinking about economic development, or you're thinking about collaboration across.
Well, the point is all of the above. Or? If you take these examples of what's happening in each of these places of conflict, and you go back to my question about how it's the same, not different, it's getting at the absence of work, not by creating traditional companies, but getting the fruits of work. It's getting at taking people in isolation who might be in a sectarian conflict and bringing in them in communities where they collaborate. It's providing pathways to learn, to be mentored, to gather knowledge and learn about what's happening in the rest of the world. It's that whole package of associations.
Which is what Alan is all about. Yeah. So yeah. You get the last word, Alan.
Well, I mean, there's an interesting point, and it's actually being teased out here in a good way. Again, where I fundamentally see a flaw in Neil's logic is right now there are 1,000, 1,500 community labs. When he talks about a million, a billion, and a trillion, it just changes. And so people can make guns in their house. The power, and everything Neil says about the Fab Labs is true. There is a community ethos, both in individual labs and the network, that is incredible. So I think to rephrase the question is, as we go from 1,000 to 100,000 to a million to a billion, how do you keep that community ethos? What are the norms? What are the standards? What are the technologies? I'm kind of realizing it for the first time. What makes those things, the reason they're not building guns is they really are community labs. They really are incredible. But as we go to personal fabrication, who's to say that those community values won't exist when, you know, there's billions of these? And I think that's a great question to tackle.
The challenge I would give everybody listening is, if anybody can make anything anywhere, it turns on its side how we live, learn, work, play. And there's this profound challenge and profound opportunity to reinvent how those work. And the incumbents in those areas actually aren't of that much use. You know, it's easy to find the technical innovators. It's much harder to find the organizational innovators. And that's really what's needed now.
Yeah. And the organizational innovators, we definitely learned this writing the book, have to understand the technology at a pretty deep level to understand the social implications.
Yeah. Please join me in thanking Joel, Neil, and Alan Gershenfeld.
This program featured three brothers and co-authors of the book How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. They are Neil Gershenfeld, director of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms, Alan Gershenfeld, the co-founder and president of Eline Media, and Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld, a professor at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.